This time on your weekly constitutional.
Essentially, if you walk into a salon and they're charging you less than $20 for a manicure or a pedicure, the likelihood that they are trafficking laborers is very high. And now they're beginning to uncover very significant ties between labor wages and labor trafficking and also sex trafficking.
That was Jennifer Bolt, a third-year law student at the Duncan School of Law at Lincoln Memorial University. She wrote a paper for me on human trafficking that's very disturbing but very important to learn about. We'll also hear from another student of mine, D.T. Christmas, who writes about a different topic. He advocates the right of women to go topless in public, just like men. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about two seminar papers.
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
I teach a wide variety of constitutional courses at Lincoln Memorial University's law school. Sometimes I teach the introductory constitutional law course, and I have 70 or 80 or more students there. Sometimes I get to teach a seminar. Lincoln's Constitution was one I taught recently. Earlier, I taught one on the First Amendment. And I've long thought that some of those seminar papers are so interesting that I should discuss them on the air with you. So this week, a real treat. We'll hear from two of my students. First, we'll hear from Jennifer Bolt, who's a 3L student at the Duncan School of Law. And last fall, she wrote about human trafficking. The title of her paper was From Gold Rush to Gold Nails. And she tells the story of how slavery, in the form of indentured servitude, persisted from before Lincoln until recently, mostly in the West and mostly involving Asians. Then we'll hear from another student, D.T. Christmas, who strongly advocates that women should have the same right as men to go topless in public. Let's start with Jen.
I wrote a paper for your class last semester, fall 2019. The class was Lincoln's Constitution, and I embarked down a path of researching the history of Chinese and Asian immigrants in the United States.
We have to pause right there, Jen, because, of course, I think most of the seminar papers I get in Lincoln's Constitution, which is a course that I started offering, and I actually created the course a couple of years ago because we thought it would be appropriate to have a course specifically devoted to Lincoln and constitutional law at a university named for Abraham Lincoln. And most of the papers I get in that seminar are people who want to write about his suspension of the writ of habeas corpus or the Emancipation Proclamation, all of which are perfectly decent topics. But some students always come up with something very creative. So once again, what did you research?
I researched the history of specifically Asian immigration to the United States and abuses of those immigrants.
And a lot of that was happening just before Abraham Lincoln became president, wasn't it?
Before, during, and after, yes.
And that was kind of your thesis, wasn't it? That we didn't really abolish all slavery. We abolished African-American slavery, but Asian-American slavery, in at least some forms, continued to exist right on through this whole process.
That is correct, unfortunately. We tried very hard to restore rights to our African-American citizens in the wake of the Civil War. But Chinese and other immigrants from Asia simply got left out of that. And I think there were very specific reasons for that, cultural reasons of necessity, and just not knowing what to do with that subculture.
Interesting. When did Asians first start coming to the United States in significant numbers?
Well, the first significant influx was during the gold rush in the mid-1800s in California. Mm-hmm. And as you can imagine, there was a need for cheap labor to mine those mines and try to find that gold. And American workers who'd already begun to think of themselves as having a right to certain wages and, you know, other workers' rights, they didn't want to do it. So we had a whole bunch of people coming over from specifically China at that time. And the Chinese immigrants that were coming from very bad circumstances. There was a lot of poverty, disease, poor worker conditions for the laborers in China, skilled and unskilled. And specifically, that seems to be what the issue centered around as I started my research, was the the laborers, not so much the educated people coming from China. As many horrible things didn't seem to happen to them as did to the people without education, without their own means when they got to the country.
So poor immigrants from a country that looks different, where the nationality looks different from the people who were already there, who were at the bottom of the barrel, and no surprise, they got treated worse. Well, how were they treated during the gold rush?
Not very well at all. In fact, one of the first issues that really shocked me was that even though indentured servitude for white and black Americans was no longer legal by the time Lincoln came to office, largely it had been made illegal in the states individually. And then, of course, the 13th Amendment made it illegal on a national scale for those white and black Americans. Did not touch Asian Americans, unfortunately. Indentured servitude remained a common practice for those Asian immigrants coming in throughout the 1800s.
We've talked about indentured servitude before, and most people who've heard of it think of it as being, you know, you sign a document and you allow yourself, you trade your labor for a certain number of years in exchange for some benefit at the end of that time, maybe a grant of land or something of that sort. Was that the form that these Chinese indentured servitudes took?
No, and it sounds not so bad even when put in those terms, but the practice was typically much different regardless of race as it was practiced in the United States. You know, the typical abuses that people are aware of. In the early part of our nation's history, the late 1600s on, you know, you'd have these Europeans come over as a result of the 30 Years' War decimating Central Europe. And they would come over and they'd sign this contract and they would be expected to work for a certain term of years. And then the payoff at the end, contractually, was a certain amount of corn and some clothing, typically. Now, sometimes they'd get land as well. The problem being that as an indentured servant, you have no rights to enforce any kind of grievances against your employer or master. So abuses flourished. You had contracts extended for very subjective reasons on the part of the master. Anything, any kind of excuse they could make up, they would use to extend. You know, if you cost them money in any way, if you embarrass them, if you, you know, don't live up to their expectations, they can extend that period. Oftentimes, indentured servants were beaten to death, not uncommon, and of course, all kinds of human rights violations. Now, as that phased out, primarily because there were fewer people coming from Europe who needed that transportation cost paid for in advance, slavery began to grow out of that at the same time. And there were a couple of socioeconomic reasons around that. But just suffice it to say, as indentured servitude faded, slavery grew, with the exception, again, of those Chinese immigrants coming in as indentured servants. And if you thought that the Europeans were treated poorly, that was really nothing compared to the abuses of the Chinese immigrants through a comparable system to indentured servitude. It wasn't called indentured servitude. It was called the credit ticket system. But functionally, it was exactly the same thing, without the payoff at the end of any kind of corn, clothing, land, anything like that. And those contracts were typically extended. You could pay, according to some estimates, up to six times the cost of the contracted amount that you agreed to in the beginning.
In terms of time?
Time and money. For the Chinese, it was their wages that were garnished because they didn't exactly have a master like typical European indentured servants did. What they did have was a contract that included their passage, the cost for the passage, the employment that would happen when they arrived, and the garnishment from that separate employer to the company that transported them.
So it sounds like the people holding these indentures pretty much started out by draining the Chinese immigrants dry, getting them to sign away their freedom, supposedly for a period of years. And then once they got them in that terrible situation, you know, in a far off land where they didn't speak the language, then they just essentially turned them into slaves, just kept extending their contracts and treated them horribly.
Yes, and one of the things I found most disturbing about it was that in contrast to those Europeans that were brought over, the recruiters for the Chinese immigrants way back in the 1800s still maintained a presence in China. And if you didn't live up to your contract or if you stepped out of line in any way, they would threaten your relatives still at home in China.
That sounds like the mafia.
Doesn't it?
Oh, my goodness gracious. Okay, so you've got this terrible system in place starting around the gold rush, so around the 1840s. What happens over there? Did the Civil War and the emancipation of African Americans have any effect on the system?
No. In fact, the only effect it really had was to increase the need for the cheap Chinese labor. Because as the gold rush dwindled, the next project that came along was Lincoln's Transcontinental Railroad.
Oh, my.
So while we don't have a whole lot of evidence about how Lincoln actually felt about Asian immigrants, there are a couple of key things that let us know that it was not a battle he was prepared to fight at the very least.
Well, what did you find out in that regard?
Well, we found out that the year before the Emancipation Proclamation was issued, Lincoln actually signed the Cooley Trade Act, which was not a nice thing to do, essentially. It seems to me he had to take two sides on the same issue. One was that he needed the cheap labor for the Transcontinental Railroad, or at least the companies in charge of building it needed that cheap labor. So he couldn't pay very close attention to that. But on the other side of the political issue, we have free laborers in America losing their minds over not being able to get work because of this cheap labor being brought in. So he has to do something about this to appease the laborers in this country that were born here and working here. So the Anti-Cooley Act essentially gave Lincoln the right to seize ships that were carrying Chinese laborers. And those became the property of the executive office at that point.
Okay, let me get this straight then. You've used a word here that I suspect is considered offensive today, though it's not currently used. The word coolie, I'm guessing, was a derogatory term that was applied to these poor laborers.
Yes, it was.
Okay.
And it is still considered a very derogatory term.
Well, then we certainly apologize if we've given offense to anybody, but this is part of the historical record. Okay, so Lincoln signs a bill, the Anti-Cooley Act, that is designed to restrict Chinese immigration, even though there was a growing need for labor on the Transcontinental Railroad, and his preference was that that would go to native-born Americans, that labor.
It seems to be, again, we don't have a whole lot in the record regarding that. We do know that there was pressure on him to start stemming the flow of cheap immigration labor at that point, which sounds familiar, given our current situation with immigration in the United States.
Well, that was 1862, the year before the Emancipation Proclamation. And so, okay, some of the same issues cropping up, as you say, again and again. Well, bring it forward for us. After Lincoln died, what happened to the Chinese laborers? How long did this system continue?
Oh, wow. Well, frankly, the abuses continued largely through the Second World War.
Oh, my.
Yeah, which was very shocking to me as well. But things such as, for instance, the Exclusionary Act, which was the only act in our nation's history targeted at a specific ethnic and socioeconomic group to exclude them from coming into the country, and that was, once again, those Chinese skilled and unskilled laborers.
When was that passed?
After Lincoln was assassinated, about 20 years, I believe, the 1880s.
Mm-hmm.
But it was only supposed to last for 10 years initially.
Mm-hmm.
However, due to different extensions and other political acts that occurred around it, it was extended to 1943.
Well, that's remarkable. We were actually allied with significant forces in China during World War II.
Funny you should bring that up. That's actually one of the reasons that it was allowed to expire finally.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional, and I'm Stuart Harris. And today I'm speaking with one of my students at Lincoln Memorial University. Her name is Jennifer Bolt, and she's written a paper about human trafficking before, during, and after the presidency of Abraham Lincoln. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with two of my students at Lincoln Memorial University. D.T. Christmas will come on the show later. He wrote a paper about, he advocates allowing women to go topless just like men do in public. But first, we've been hearing from Jennifer Bolt, who has a far more tragic topic, the existence of Asian American slavery in the form of indentured servitude that existed before and after Abraham Lincoln's presidency, and indeed really was fed by restrictions on Chinese immigration, which only stopped in World War II. Did things get any better after that?
Yeah, things got better from the 40s until about 1970. Nothing huge on the political radar. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that Asian Americans would tell you that their, grandparents and parents were not treated well during that time, but there were no new political acts targeted at them. And then we flash forward to 1970, and we're talking about the Vietnam War era. And this is the most interesting part of this entire subject to me. The current issue that we're having with labor and sex trafficking of Asian immigrants primarily started because of something nice Tippi Hedren, the actress, wanted to do. Tippi Hedren was in L.A. in 1970, and there was a refugee camp of Korean and Vietnamese women. And she'd heard about this, and she wanted to check in on them, do a little humanitarian act and see what she could do for them. So she went to visit this refugee camp. And when she went there, these Vietnamese women were absolutely entranced with her beautiful nails and her manicure.
Wait a minute, her fingernails?
Her fingernails, yes. They thought that it was just spectacular what they had been able to do with her nails. Well, she, in an effort to, help this community find a way to support themselves, brought her personal manicurist to the refugee camp and taught these women how to give manicures.
That seems like a good thing.
It does, doesn't it? And it caught like wildfire. And people became very excited about this. The women in the camp, very quickly started setting up their own businesses to give manicures and pedicures to the wealthy and elite of L.A. and, the more populated areas of California. So flash forward to 2015. In 2015, the New York Times published an article called The Price of Nice Nails. And that was revelatory for the country. It was by Sarah Maslin Neer, and it exposed a problem that most people had no idea was going on. And that was that many Asian immigrants, primarily Vietnamese, Korean, and Chinese, were being brought into the country. They were actively being recruited by other Asians in their home countries with promises that sound really not enticing to you and me because we've been fortunate. Promises of, say, $13 a week in wages. And they would bring these young women over and men and start them on an informal kind of apprenticeship in these nail salons. And unfortunately, what was going on was that there were just rampant abuses of wage rights, worker rights, and all these things that are still going on. And essentially, if you walk into a salon and they're charging you less than $20 for a manicure or a pedicure, the likelihood that they are trafficking laborers is very high.
And it gets worse, doesn't it?
It does. It does, unfortunately. In the wake of that article, with public awareness being raised, other agencies and people began to investigate, and now they're beginning to uncover very significant ties between labor wages and labor trafficking and also sex trafficking. Mm. So essentially, you will have a young woman working all day in a salon for nothing, either living at the salon or in a very crowded space with many other people or at the salon owner's home, and making zero money to only cash tips for unknown periods of time to pay for their transportation over. And then in the evenings, oftentimes, unfortunately, they will be used as sex workers, sometimes in the salon, sometimes other places.
Are these immigrants, are they documented?
Yes, they are. However, they are unaware of their rights in many cases. Mm. Lots of times they have a visitor or worker visa they're brought in. And typically the owner of the salon, who is most likely another immigrant from Asia, will tell them that they have to hold on to their papers, their documentation. So they don't have access to their own documentation. They don't have any knowledge of any rights they have. And on top of that, the salon owners themselves are very unaware of the rights that they're supposed to be giving their workers. And part of that is because of the culture that they all come from. There's this kind of embracing of this hierarchy that it's the salon owners tend to feel that they are heroic for taking the risk of bringing these usually documented, sometimes undocumented workers over and teaching them a skill. And they feel like they're giving these people an in to the United States.
Even as they're prostituting them?
Yes, yes.
Oh, my, that's an interesting attitude.
Right. They consider it the dues that they are entitled to for giving this young person a chance.
So is there an end point to this? I mean, does this horror ever end for an individual woman who is serving these capacities?
Sometimes. And that's one of the reasons that these young women agree to these situations and these conditions, is because what they'll do is they'll say, you know, if you get through this internship period, then we'll set you up with your own shop. But unfortunately, what that means is that they're just propagating the problem, because then these new owners of these new shops continue to bring in these, you know, documented or undocumented laborers and exploit them moving forward. And I really want to stress that the wage violations are rampant. Even if you go to a salon and you say, okay, I want to put a tip for this young woman or young man on my Visa debit card receipt, unless that tip is in cash, they're likely never going to see it.
You know what this reminds me of, Jen? It reminds me of the cycle of child abuse, where abused children grow up and then become abusers themselves.
Yeah.
And again, it's so reminiscent of the early practices and that have been here at least since the 1840s. What can be done about this?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. And the original article in the New York Times was a first very good step in raising public awareness. And, you know, as Americans, we are so obsessed with getting the best price for things. And I think that when you know what's going on, you have a responsibility to say, I am not going to pay $15 for a manicure or a pedicure. I'm going to go somewhere where I don't feel like I'm exploiting someone to have nice nails.
Well, this is, you know, it cuts both ways. On the one hand, you might want to patronize a shop, you don't want to stop because you want to give some benefit to these poor young women. But if you're actually patronizing the shop, you're helping to propagate this system. But I'm curious, even if you pay more for a manicure, how do you know that the extra money isn't just going into the owner's pocket?
Typically, they have not found that to be the case so far.
Mm-hmm.
Just because if you're paying more for it, chances are that the owner is a little more sophisticated, or at least is in a market where they can't get away with it as easily. So that doesn't seem to be as much a part of the problem at this stage. But we can say that if you're paying less than $20, the chances are high that you're contributing to that. And without dehumanizing these people at all, I tend to compare it to the issue of puppy mills. You know, you can feel sorry for the puppies that don't get a home, but in the long run, it is a better solution to not patronize those places.
Well, other than individuals making that choice to not go to such places, what can be done to stop this problem? I mean, is it enforcement or do we need new laws?
We do. And in fact, one of the emerging issues around this is that protections for victims of human trafficking are being pulled back by the current administration rather than supported. So they've limited some of the rights and extensions to stay in the country that had been available. So in other words, someone who could have been classified prior to this administration as a victim of human trafficking would have had some built-in protection. And a specific classification could have gotten you some help to and allowed you to stay here. Now, with the repeal of those or the pulling back of those, it's much more likely that if you report yourself as a victim of human trafficking, you will be deported to your home country, which keeps a lot of people from raising any alarms, unfortunately.
Seem to be moving in the wrong direction there. What about, any other legal reforms other than the way we enforce the law, the way we interpret the law that currently exists?
Well, I mean, this is highly controversial, but I think that one of the issues we have to face is that we need to legalize prostitution. Turning anything into a black market allows abuses to occur. And with an estimated 16% of men in the United States paying for sex, there is a market. It's not going to go away. If we legalize it, as other countries in the world have, we can at least regulate it, and we can definitely cut down on the abuses of trafficked people from other nations that way. Because typically those are the people that are the victims of sex trafficking because they don't have any other choices and they can't report without fear of being deported.
Well, Jen, I've had discussions about legalization of prostitution many times, and my wife, who's also a law professor, is actually very much in favor of it for the very reasons that you cite. Not that she or I approve of prostitution, but it's, it's there. It's the world's oldest profession. It's not going away. What I hadn't realized before reading your paper and talking with you about your research is how this has a particular impact on Asian immigrants, and so it's maybe another reason to at least consider legalizing prostitution. Well, I think this is coming to the end of our time together. Any final thoughts before we leave, Jen?
One final note, I was shocked to learn that there is a relatively high percentage of Nepalese immigrants who are also part of this issue. That was unexpected to me. And one last point, Thank you for being a wonderful teacher.
Hey, you don't have to kiss up to me anymore, Jen. You're not in my class. I'm not going to have to give you any more grades.
So if I don't have to, maybe that means it's sincere.
Aw, shucks. Okay, thanks, Jen Bolt. We appreciate you and appreciate you bringing this very important issue to everyone's attention. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we are talking to two of my seminar students who've written some really interesting papers. We just heard from Jennifer Bolt on the tragic subject of Asian American effective slavery in the United States. Now let's turn to a different topic that's perhaps a little bit less disturbing, or maybe not. My student D.T. Christmas strongly advocates that women should have the same right as men to go topless in public.
Basically what it is an argument for a woman's right to go topless in public under the freedom of expression of the First Amendment.
I just got to pause right there and say, interesting topic. Secondly, don't most people consider this an equal protection issue?
They do, and on the surface, you would think. However, the Supreme Court has ruled that your clothing choice, the way you present your body, is very expressive. And there are a lot of hang-ups that you have to go through when it comes to equal protection issues that I felt like maybe we could bypass if we looked at this a little differently.
That was a really interesting way to look at it because, as you point out in your paper, the challenges that have occurred thus far on the basis of equal protection have certainly not succeeded. And more generally, bringing equal protection claims is a very difficult thing to do. And people are surprised by that when they first learn of it. But I think that's the reason you have so many civil rights statutes, federal laws that are not constitutional, but are based on the concept of equal protection. Typically, if you feel like you're being discriminated against, you're going to sue somebody under a federal or state statute rather than trying to pursue it solely based on equal protection. So that's generally hard to do. So I thought it was a very interesting perspective. But before we go any further, I recall the day in class when you announced what you were going to focus on. What was the reaction of your classmates?
It was a lot of eye rolling and huffing and puffing, and people thought I was I wasn't taking things serious enough. And I tried to ensure everybody that I was being very serious, and that this was this was something that I have held dear to my heart since a child. It kind of sparked in my mind while I was watching an episode of Cops one time. And the idea of, you know, why don't we have these rights? You know, why is it so one-sided? And in your class, I said, you know what, I'm going to talk about this. And people are kind of cold to the touch when I first talk about it. And it takes a lot of loosening them up, you know, a lot of talking about it before they, you know, open up and are willing to hear my arguments.
It's one of those topics that people can find amusing, at least at first blush. And that's what I seem to recall it was especially your female classmates who were saying, oh, DT, you just want to do this to have an excuse to look at women's breasts.
I was accused of that, yes.
Yes, you were. But did their attitudes change as the semester went on?
They changed. Thankfully, they changed. I think when they started to, because any time you hear something, on the front end, even, you know, something that's so controversial as this, your first instinct is to go to the societal norms and culture that we've been ingrained with. And that is to say, oh my God, why would you ever want to advocate that? And then when you dig into the issue a little closer and you look at it and you start dissecting why, and you start asking why every time you turn, every time you read an opinion, every time you read a statute, you look at history, ask why, you start seeing that there's something great to be said and something that needs to be advocated for. The very first page of the paper, I talk about that this is the only law that we still have on the books that blatantly gives a right to one gender, one sex, and puts the other one in jail for.
And women do occasionally go to jail for this, don't they?
Absolutely, and we start now even more than ever. You know, if you've been tuning into this kind of thing, you see that recently there's been a case to where a woman has been basically charged with lewd conduct to a minor simply to exposing, you know, the full breast.
Yeah, there's an interesting backstory to that. This is the one out of Utah, right?
Exactly. Yes, sir.
What were the circumstances in which this woman allegedly exposed herself to these children?
She was in I believe it was a garage. They were doing some kind of construction work.
Her and her husband.
Mm-hmm. And they had taken their shirts off.
Mm-hmm.
And I read one report that she had gotten some insulation in her shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Taking it off, and she was trying to explain to her children, it was her stepchildren, that there's nothing inherently wrong with being nude. We're born nude. Your major religions talks about the very first part of you know, God creating people in nudity. And she tried to explain that there's nothing wrong with pure nudity. And, you know, there was a lot of fuss being made about that, and she was charged.
They were her stepchildren, and I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect that when the children went back to their biological mother, they mentioned this, and that's probably the route through which the complaint was made to the police.
Yes.
But I think they were installing drywall at the time, so it wasn't a sexy situation. It was a getting sweaty in the garage situation and maybe having insulation in your shirt situation. And then the kids walked in. Maybe a teachable moment, but that's not how the police look at it because, as you say, she's been charged with lewdness. And if she's convicted, she's going to have to go on a sex registry, isn't she? A sex offender registry.
And that is the... And when you look at the problem from that point of view, I don't know how anyone can not be completely outraged by that. You know, I don't understand how you can sit there and you can see this problem and you can see how the laws tend to look, and it's degrading. It's basically degrading. And not be, wow, we need to change this somehow.
All right, so that's the problem. You've already described how equal protection has not worked for women. How does the First Amendment protect this sort of activity? What, start with the basics. Is free speech, is that included in how you dress or don't dress?
That is, and it is the way you dressed and what how you express your clothing, whether it be armbands or a particular type of uniform or clothing, can be expressive conduct. And we see that through, you know, our Supreme Court has talked about that.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with a couple of my seminar students about some fascinating papers they wrote. We've just been speaking with D.T. Christmas, who strongly advocates a woman's right to go bare-chested in public. And now let's finish my discussion with my 3L law student, D.T. Christmas, at the Duncan School of Law, who's written a paper that you might think would be based on equal protection, the right of a woman to equally expose her breasts in public in the same way that men do. But D.T. was in a seminar on the First Amendment, and he thought there was some free expression at issue here. There was actually a case many years ago, Cohen versus California, and I won't quote what was on a young man's leather jacket. I'll paraphrase. It was 1969. It was Vietnam, and he wore it to court, actually. And on the back of his leather jacket, he had put the words, F the draft. And so that, to me, was always a case that showed that, of course, the clothing you wear, especially if it bears written words, can be protected under the free speech clause of the First Amendment. But as you point out, it goes further than that. I mean, every time you put on a piece of clothing, you're arguably expressing something.
And that is true. There is also, before I kind of looked at the First Amendment, the freedom of expression, it is important to note that the argument of being different, of the male and the female breast being different, is a lot of the reason why you look at this and say, hey, you know what, they're not the same. That's why they're classified differently. But that completely defies the face of the Supreme Court in Reed versus Reed, where the Supreme Court says that, you know, traditional views of sex cannot be used to justify a discriminatory law.
Mm-hmm.
And right here and right now, that's what we have. You know, we have, you know, this notion that because the way society views one versus the other and their history and their traditional views, we have the right to promote decency and morality.
Let's return to that idea in just a moment. I believe Reed versus Reed, which you accurately quoted, was an equal protection case. And that's fine. But again, equal protection hasn't been extended as far as you want it to be. Let's again just go back to the basics. Is all clothing automatically considered expressive conduct under First Amendment doctrine?
Not all clothing. I mean, we have tests such as the O'Brien test. Clothing, just like general toplessness, would not be completely expressive. There has to be some sort of message being portrayed. There has to be some sort of message. Whether it would be, you know, I am protesting, I am doing something, general anything is usually not sufficient.
Okay, so you mentioned before black armbands. That's a famous case, the Tinker case, where a 13-year-old girl went to school during the Vietnam War wearing a black armband. And that relatively simple piece of clothing, which by itself has no words on it, nonetheless conveyed a message of protest of the war. And the Supreme Court seems to have adopted the idea that you have to have a specific message you're trying to convey. And moreover, it's a message that a reasonable observer would understand, right?
Yeah, yes. That's correct.
And that's the problem. That's why not all clothing is considered to be protected by the First Amendment because, you know, like you point out in your paper, school dress codes, which prohibit you from wearing other clothing, are typically upheld. Because, you know, the other clothing is not necessarily expressing anything else except I like this particular shirt today. And that's not enough for First Amendment protection under the current doctrine. And that leads further then to why, as you point out, general nudity is not going to be considered expressive conduct. But you think that a woman going topless should be considered expressive conduct. Could you pick up on that?
Yes. You can even cloak this in what I call, you know, civil disobedience. For example, it can be something as simple as, I am at the beach, I'm hot, I am proud of my body at the beach, I want to show it off. It could be something, a lot of times, depending on what we wear in certain settings, we're trying to attract a certain person. And it can even go as far as not having the right to do something. I am now protesting that I should have that right.
That seems to me to be the easiest argument for you to make. If a woman is in a parade that is devoted to the right to be topless, and by the way, there is a group that we've mentioned on the show several times that you mentioned in your paper called Free the Nipple, because that's essentially the only part of the breast that a woman is typically prohibited from showing is the areola and the nipple. That's easy. I think that's your best argument to make, that in that particular context, these women are using their toplessness to make their point more effectively than they could wearing shirts. And I think that's easy to understand, but that has not been upheld by the courts, has it?
It has not. It actually has the adverse effect, because it all goes down to the exact same thing: how we look at the woman, at the breast of the female sect. And that is, for some reason, all the courts have said that they have a interest in promoting morality and decency.
Mm-hmm.
And until we stop looking at this issue as being indecent, and once we step away from what we've been told our whole life, that's always going to be the problem. Because no matter if I'm protesting, if I'm in a rally, if I'm at a beach, it all goes down to they have the right to prohibit this activity.
And that's always problematic, isn't it? That was the argument that was made about upholding sodomy statutes. That was the argument that was made about banning gay marriage. It was just traditional notions of morality, and for many years, the courts, including the Supreme Court, said that that was part of the core power of any government, often called the police power, was to uphold public morals. But those arguments have failed in those other contexts, haven't they?
They have. And in the O'Brien test that we talked about earlier, that you are far more familiar with than I am, it talks about that, not greater than is essential to the furtherance of that interest.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever interest you're trying to protect, you can't go beyond that. You can't, a lot of times this broad category of we're just going to stop everything usually is overreaching. And one of the arguments I make when it comes to the First Amendment, freedom of expression, is that statutes should not completely ban all forms of female toplessness. A lot of, especially in Tennessee, they talk about it's to help combat criminal activity and all these things.
Well, let's pause on that one. So the argument by the state of Tennessee is that if women expose their breasts, what, that men are going to start sexually harassing them or assaulting them?
Exactly. And we've heard that argument all the way back to the 20s and 30s.
In fact, you made a very important point about that. Back in the 20s and 30s, similar restrictions were placed on men.
My very religious grandmother, when I was telling her about this, she had her reservations. And then I told her, in fact, I said, have you ever watched The Great Gatsby, the movie? You see the men wearing a one-piece bathing suit, because up until the 1935, a man couldn't show his breast in public. And actually, this all came to a halt when, I think 35 or 40 men protesting was arrested for showing their breast in public.
That is just remarkable. Okay, so we've been here before, and men gained the right to go topless in public, but women still have not. Okay, the protest argument, as I said, is the easiest one to make, is protected speech or expression under the First Amendment. You mentioned a couple of other reasons, though, that women might be expressing themselves, a couple of other ways, and I want to take them one by one. First, you said she could be at the beach and she simply wants to show off her breasts, as she might show off her legs. And people wearing bathing suits are, they're, in some cases, they at least they want to show off. And you pointed out that men do this all the time, that men go out and they go to the gym and they get all pumped up. And then they go out and go in their swimming trunks out on the beach. In fact, it's sort of amusing to me. On one occasion when I was going swimming, I was going with a friend, and he paused, picked up his barbell, and did a number of reps. And I said, why are you doing that now? He says, oh, I want to go be pumped before I go out on the beach. So he can go out and try to show off his muscly torso, but a woman cannot show off her breasts for exactly the same reason.
That is correct. Everything we do in a lot of regards is expressive. If you're going to be lecturing, you might wear a tie. You might wear something that is appealing to the audience.
Now, DT, I have to correct you. Have you ever seen me lecturing in a tie?
I have not. And you should take pride in that.
Maybe I'm expressing something there, too. What really gets me, too, is that you went all the way. You basically said, even if a woman is trying to attract sexual attention, even if she's looking for a date, to put it simply, that's okay too. And if you think about it, both men and women will dress in ways that will be attractive to the people they're trying to attract. And I think the classic example is that a woman might decide that she wants to bare her legs because she thinks her legs are pretty. We don't see anything wrong with a woman exposing her legs, even if that's her motive. But if she wants to expose her torso, she can't.
Absolutely. And when you put it like that, it just kind of is like, why? The fact that the courts try to interpret a particularized message and they say, okay, if you're trying to express this or that, we're not going to buy it. Somehow or another, the way you do with your body and what you do with your body and the way you express your body, I'm going to have to understand what it is or I'm not going to give you protection on it. And there's a vast array of reasons why you would do something. If you look at it in the point of a man, why does he go shirtless and topless?
Mm-hmm.
What are the reasons why he would do it? He's working out, he's jogging, he is going swimming.
Yep, very interesting arguments. So really, there's a variety of ways to look at this as expressive conduct. And generally speaking, I mean, if the court agrees with that, then trying to regulate that expression, the content of that expression, is subject to something we call strict scrutiny. That is, the government has to have a compelling reason for doing so, and then, as you mentioned earlier, has to use the least restrictive means to do so. So we come back again to the issue that you've been pounding on, that, you know, what is the compelling reason that a government has for telling a woman that she cannot expose her breasts? And it's that old idea of nudity being inherently bad, at least nudity of female breasts.
Exactly right.
And I saw a funny cartoon the other day, and it showed two people on a beach. They were both middle-aged. They were both significantly overweight. One was a man, and the man was speaking to the woman saying, that's disgusting, you exposing your breasts that way, because she was not wearing a top. And as he was saying this, he had man breasts that were about as big as hers. We've all seen that guy at the beach, right, who should really not have a shirt off, but does, and quite frankly, can have breasts that are as large as many women's.
And that leads me to, I mentioned earlier about what was the kind of the movement, the first thing that brought this issue up to me was watching an episode of Cops when I was a kid, and it was New Orleans. And there was an individual who was transitioning from a male to a female.
Mm-hmm.
And legally, she was still a male, although she was holding herself out to be female. And she had her shirt off. It was Mardi Gras. And the officer said, well, because you're holding yourself out to be a woman, even though you're legally a man, you still are going to need to put your shirt back on, and we're going to take you to jail.
Well, that was a creative interpretation of the statute.
It was. And it sounds like a lot of our justices we have, we're going to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks.
We're running short of time here, so I want to bring up something. It's the one quibble I had with your paper, is that I had several times asked you during our conversations over the semester to say that this is somehow different than going bottomless, okay? If men and women can go topless, then why not complete nudity? How would you differentiate that? How are the arguments any different for below the waist and above the waist?
My rationale is this. When it comes to nudity, the law looks at a woman's breast and genitals and sexual acts that you will do all the same. Nudity is defined not as a male's breast, but a female's breast and the genitals. There is no differentiating between a female's breast and what's below the waist. There's none.
Okay, so you would actually be in favor of repealing restrictions on public nudity.
Yes. The argument is that before we do anything, you build a, if anybody's ever been to Sunday school, you know you build a house on a rock and you have to lay the foundation.
Mm-hmm.
First, we have to attack why the breast issue. Because that's the one of the, that's one of the things a lot of people, all the critics have the paper, is like, well, what if I just take my pants off? Well, no. We're not talking. That would be nudity. My argument is a woman's breast is not, should not be considered nudity.
Interesting. Okay. I think that there can be arguments made consistent with your arguments in favor of permitting total nudity. But I think the differentiating factor here is that, not to put too fine a point on it, that our, the areas below the waist also have excretory functions. And you could make a much stronger public health argument that the government should have the ability to at least require some sort of minimal covering of that part of the body, because otherwise it's going to be a conduit for spreading germs. You don't have that argument with breasts because there's no excretory function. I mean, they might secrete milk, but milk is not a poison, is not a disease. So I think you could probably differentiate that and respond to those arguments in that way. At any rate, that's the only quibble I had with your paper. I very much really appreciated reading it and working with you on it. And I thank you very much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, sir.
Following its drafting at the Pennsylvania State House, the U.S. Constitution encountered a year-long battle over ratification between the Federalist and Anti-Federalist factions. Leading the Federalists were James Madison, John Jay, and Alexander Hamilton, each of whom authored several essays in strong support of ratification, collectively known as the Federalist Papers. Leading the Anti-Federalists were Patrick Henry, George Mason, and Thomas Jefferson. The Anti-Federalists were wary of a strong central government becoming too tyrannical. They also believed that a constitution without an enumeration of individual rights would allow the government to trample on the rights of the citizen. The first state to ratify the Constitution was Delaware. However, the debate focused intensely on the states of New York and Virginia, and both state legislatures voted for ratification. New Hampshire was the last necessary state to ratify the Constitution. This is Tyler Stanley with the Madison Minute.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to my students at the Lincoln Memorial University Law School, Jen Bolt and D.T. Christmas. I thought those were really interesting discussions, didn't you? Maybe I'll have to have a few more students on in the future. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check him out on Spotify. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.